Welcome to the Minerals and Royalties Podcast, the home of CEOs and investors in the minerals and royalties space.
Hey guys, this is Tim Powell from the Minerals and Royalties Authority. I recently sat down with Scott Brinkman, founder of Royalty Guardian, a minerals advisory firm that looks to level the playing field for mineral owners who are looking to seek answers about their royalty payments. During the episode, Scott goes into great detail on all the different ways royalty owners typically get underpaid and how his team goes about getting that remedied with operators. Let's jump into the episode and hear more of what Scott had to say.
All right, Scott, good afternoon and welcome onto the podcast. Good to have you.
Great to be here, Tim.
Yeah, no, listen, we had a good chat at NAEP. It was good to meet you. I think, you know, what you're doing is relevant. There's a handful of ways to make money in the mineral space. One is obviously on the buy, but then the management side, you know, unbeknownst to a lot of people, a lot of stuff can slip through the cracks, and that's your world. And so I can't wait to dive into that in more detail. But before we do that, love to set the context personally for you. I mean, you had a fairly full career before starting Royalty Guardian, and by the looks of it, from a CV perspective, doesn't really have much to do with royalties. So I'm curious to see how you got into the seat you're in today. But over to you. You know, where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school? I see you were a banker for many years and then started to get into land. So how did you transition kind of into finance, then into oil and gas and all the above? Floor is yours.
Yeah, I call myself a recovering banker, and people always say, well, yeah, how's that going? It's still a work in progress. You know, 15 years in a trust department taught me the importance of ethics and working for other people, even when you could kind of front run them or use their information. It's better not to. This could be a whole different sidebar conversation, but if you put the CFA standard of ethics up against the AAPL, there's some big gaps there.
When you say working in trust, were you working in the mineral trust departments at these banks? Or
no, I started in what was Texas Commerce in their trust department. Yeah. And I was managing municipal bond portfolios. My background was in municipal credit. Went to Austin College undergrad, went to Carnegie Mellon Graduate School in public affairs, and was very interested in infrastructure development, roads, bridges, ports, and energy. Traveled around the state writing credit reports on municipalities back in the day when you had to find the town hall by looking for the water tower.
You know, you said you went to Carnegie Mellon. Does the name Randy Pausch ring a bell? Are you familiar with the last lecture?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, yeah. So for those listening who are not familiar, there's a tradition at Carnegie Mellon called the last lecture where professors go up and they say, if this was the last lecture you ever were to give, what would it be on? And Randy Pausch, it went viral years ago. I think he went on Oprah, and this is kind of pre-YouTube. It's available on YouTube now, but incredible man, professor, long time at Carnegie Mellon, and he got a very rare form of cancer. And he gave this talk that was incredibly inspirational. And he said, the one thing that's fitting my whole life, he's like, this literally is my last lecture. And it was called The Brick Walls, I think, about, you know, the obstacles that come up in life and overcoming them. And, you know, when you really want something, you're on the precipice of something big, the brick walls show up, right? And anyways, if no one's listened to it, highly recommend. But Carnegie Mellon, that just kind of triggered me. But don't mean to interrupt. I digress. So please continue.
So 15 years in the trust department, and I had the gift for gab. So they would put me in front of the most important clients that they had. And I would have like the chairman of the bank, some hedge fund managers, and some of the biggest plaintiff's lawyers in town. And they said, Scott, imagine client sitting on one ear, and when you're talking to the broker with the other phone, they're on the other side, and you got a hollow head, so it just goes straight through. You have to translate what they want and protect them from what they don't want. So that's kind of the overall big brother type philosophy that I have. I've spent my whole career applying real technical knowledge to help people that don't know what it is, don't want to know. Because it truly takes, in oil and gas, takes 10,000 hours to master the land side, and it probably takes another 10 to master the royalty side. So Texas Commerce leads to Chase. Chase sends everything to New York. I went to work for Frost for 5 years. Frost moved us to Austin. Family was here. I had two small daughters. sister, mother, and went from Frost over to another Compass, and they didn't get the relationship part of this business, because it truly is about having a relationship with somebody and building on that relationship. They thought it was all transactions. Anyway, so my father-in-law has been a career land man, OU oil and gas, and land, I think he was a PLM major. Anyway, we were standing on my back porch. He goes, "Hey, if you don't want to move to New York, I can probably get you a gig till you find out your next gig." And he called a friend, and off I went to Robertson County.
Welcome to An Ounce of Prevention. The team at Our Recent Associates has partnered with Tim Powell to bring you brief legal updates on issues that matter to mineral owners, non-ops, and operators. We hope you find this segment informative. As always, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me, Rachel Reese, at rreese@rreeselaw.com. Today, we are talking about a case out of the Oklahoma Supreme Court called Trey C. versus Raker Resources. In this case, Trey C. sued to cancel a lease based on cessation of production so that J&R Energy could enforce its top lease. The facts of this case are a bit convoluted, so instead we are going to focus on the court's analysis. What you need to know from the facts is this. The parties are arguing about whether the Cohen well, which was operated by Raker Resources and was holding the Cohen lease, had ceased producing such that the Cohen lease expired. And when we say ceased producing, what we are really talking about is ceased producing in paying quantities. The Oklahoma Supreme Court did a great job in this case, explaining the difference between the amount of time that should be reviewed under a habendum clause to determine if production has ceased, and the time period prescribed in a cessation of production clause that an operator has to resume operations after production has ceased. To catch anyone up who needs it, a habendum clause is the clause in the lease that tells you how long the lease is in force. It usually says something like, "For a period of 3 years, the primary term, and for so long thereafter as oil or gas is produced in paying quantities from the lease." The cessation of production clause that Trey C. relied on reads like this. "If, after the expiration of the primary term of this lease, production on the lease premises shall cease for any cause, this lease shall not terminate, provided lessee resumes operations for drilling a well within 60 days from such cessation." Raker argued that the habendum clause and the cessation of production clause work separately, and before the 60-day period of the cessation of production clause kicks in, you first have to show that production has ceased. Trey C., on the other hand, contended that the 60-day period in the cessation of production clause actually narrows the amount of time that would be used in the habendum clause to determine cessation, down to 60 days. The Oklahoma Supreme Court disagreed with Trey C. The purpose of a cessation of production clause, according to the court, is to establish a grace period for after cessation has occurred. Since it only comes into play after cessation, it doesn't have any bearing on whether cessation has occurred. The court went on to discuss what is an appropriate review period for production in paying quantities. Citing good old Clifton v. Kuntz, the court reiterated that it's a reasonable amount of time under the circumstances. And when you look at the circumstances, you consider all matters that would influence a reasonably prudent operator. They went on to look at the facts of this case, and held that even if all the evidence presented by Trey C., which sought to establish loss of profitability for 3 months, was correct, 3 months was way too short of a review period, as a matter of law, to establish cessation. We are discussing this case today to highlight the fact that your cessation of production clause may not mean what you think it means. People often get confused about this. When you read these clauses on their face, it may seem reasonable to think that it says that if a well goes down, the lease expires in 60 days, or whatever amount of time is stated in your clause. But case law, not just in Oklahoma, tells us that to figure out when production ceases, you look at the habendum clause. Once production ceases, then you look at the cessation of production clause to determine what to do next. I hope this was helpful. As always, if you want to learn more about this or other cases that may affect you and your company, subscribe to our blog, An Ounce of Prevention, or follow Our Recent Associates on LinkedIn for the latest updates.
The information and material in this advertisement is general information about our practice and firm and is for educational and informational purposes only. This information does not offer specific legal advice, and the use of this information does not create an attorney-client relationship with RRNA or any of its attorneys. The information in this advertisement should not be considered legal advice, and persons should not act upon this information without first engaging professional legal counsel.
This is for context. This is 2004, and that gig to find the next gig lasted over a decade. You doing independently?
Yeah, exactly. The other funny story I tell is When I was working at the bank, I was used to having a Bloomberg sitting in front of me and lots of transparency and lots of numbers in a very data-rich environment. Part of what we did was look for aberrations in the data, finding golden needles and stacks of needles. And that's what you want to buy as an investment manager, the golden needle. So I had that in the back of my head, and I go off to Robertson County, and I said, you know, where are the online resources? And they said, let me show you the online. You find the paper, you stand online, you take it to the clerk, she gives you a copy of the paper back. That's your online resource. And I said, what about indexes? They said, put your first finger up. That's your index. Welcome to oil and gas.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up. I mean, I don't think anyone's going to disagree that, you know, the oil and gas space is a little bit behind on the digitalization of things and transparency and all that. I think that's one of the things that makes mineral investing interesting for institutions is there's some asymmetric information. But, you know, recently I've had talks with several folks who kind of been newer to the mineral space that have a hedge fund background. And they talk about just what you said, you know, four screens a whole career, looking for nanosecond openings of data misinformation. And the fact that you then go over to something that has as much capital flowing in and out of it as oil and gas, and you have that much really archaicness to the data, it just shocks people coming from the hedge fund world. So I think you had that kind of same eyes wide open experience, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You touched on an interesting point about the asymmetry of information, meaning one party has a lot more information than the other. And in that environment, it pays to hoard all that information. I'm not going to share it with you if I've developed all of it. And all that's based, that's what land work is. All those hedge funds, any private, they've done a lot of the title and they hoard all the land work. Oil companies send in these independent field landmen to do the verification from their side. But the real reason I got into this is because when you flip over to the mineral side, there's nothing there. They could hire a landman, and AAPL tries to qualify people, but nobody knows what a landman does. Jimmy Wright, who was the AAPL Landman of the Year, told a funny story at the last meeting. He said, my daughters were at the national convention where I got recognized. And he said, look, girls, this is how you can learn to be nationally recognized in a profession nobody knows about.
Yeah, Jimmy came on. He did an episode probably 6 months ago. A good guy.
Good guy.
Yeah.
So roll the clock forward. I'm doing field land work. A colleague of mine gets me on the phone. He goes, listen, will you talk to this lady? She's pissed. And I'm like, what? What's going on? He said, Chesapeake put her in suspense and she's looking for help. Do you want to get involved? I'm like, yeah. Rolling the clock back a bit, I did a lot of land work for brokers in Chesapeake in the Barnett Shale and found that they did some really fast stuff there. Like there's a $100 million lawsuit about properties that had gone through foreclosure and were still open. Again, these are quarter acre tracts. But when you get that much volume, it starts to add up to some real money, as they say. Anyway, so we chased Chesapeake there. I said, where is it? She said, down in LaSalle County. And she got on the phone, 80 years old, really colorful, and said, them SOBs, I used to be a bookkeeper, and I know how oil companies treat you. I'm getting cheated. Can you boys help me figure it out? She was put in suspense for a title issue. We helped it do the title research and supported her title, the attorney that ultimately won the litigation and the title dispute. But in the middle of all that, I started looking at the numbers, and it's like, you're not getting paid right. It just didn't make sense. It's like you have well A and well B, and they're right next to each other, and there's a $3 difference in the price of oil. What gives? That doesn't make any sense.
Now, I have a question on that. We recently did an episode with Luther Ott. He has a tech platform called Barrel Hub. And what Barrel Hub does, and it's just Texas data right now, is it brings transparency to midstream and marketing pricing data. So at the lease level, you can understand how many barrels of oil were sold by an operator to whatever midstream marketing company, at what price, what diffs, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that is, I think the road you're going down is errors, right? Discrepancies, clerical errors. You know, this is more, there's different pricing, this huge asymmetric information on the midstream side. And so you could have, you know, a unit side by side and the operators are getting paid $4, $5, $6, $7, $8, $9 differences. Now, there's a lot of things that can go into that, but at a high level, there's definitely a mechanism if you have awareness of it as a non-op company who can take in kind, or, you know, a mineral company with enough leverage to go to an operator or an operator, obviously, to go to the midstream company and say, hey, what the hell? Why are we getting $75 a barrel? And I know so-and-so, my neighbor, is getting $79 with this company. Do you want me to switch or can you match it? And, you know, what Luther's found with his platform is a lot of times you can get them to match it because they don't want to lose the volumes, right? So that just, you brought that up. I just, it's curious. It's interesting because I just came across that. But are you referencing just administrative errors or a little bit of both? I mean, would love for your...
Now, these were, so another story that'll illustrate the point. I was working in Kennedy in Karnes County. Lady that, and we were sitting at a lunch counter and the lady overhears that we're landmen and somehow it slipped that I was a recovering banker. And she said, well, you boys sit there. I'm going to buy you a piece of pie. And so she ran home, grabbed her check stubs and said, why am I getting paid $5 or less by this operator? It's the same oil coming out of the same wells, coming out of the same ground. Why? And I said, oh, good question. Good question. The caveat or the weird part of this is we tried to press. So as a mineral owner, you can find that data in the comptroller's office, in the comptroller records. It's a real pain in the butt to get them because you have to do it through an open records request or pay for a very expensive subscription to get the data. So you can see what you were paid and what everybody, what all your wells were paid. And if you expand the database enough, what the surrounding wells were paid at a similar month. And with the Chesapeake case, we went in there and said, hey, it was the language, the lease language was market value at point of sale. And we're like, you know, there it is. They're saying the market value is 75 and you paid 73. And they're like, no, that isn't the market value. It's the posted price that Plains or one of those big pipeline companies posts on their website, which is the average, which it's kind of like paying retail for a car. Nobody does that. Mm-hmm. It's a spot price when you show up. What am I going to do? Show up with a tanker of oil and that's the spot price you're going to pay me? It just doesn't make sense. So there's not a lot of transparency in that whole process between when it comes out at the wellhead to the take point to the processing plant, all the way to when the dollars change hands. I encourage everybody to take a hard look at the, there was a lawsuit, Crane and Shepherd versus Devon. And this little law firm in Cuero had language in there that said, if you have a take or pay contract for the oil, we get paid that contract price. So when the dollars change hands, that's what we get. Their lawyers went in and subpoenaed those contracts and they said, oh, guess what? We're subtracting $18 a barrel from that price. We're paying the mineral owners $18 a barrel less than what you're getting paid. Huge, huge case. Again, that's Crane and Shepherd versus Devon.
Wow.
But you're talking about the stuff that gets me excited are these asymmetrical information. We've built some technology that tries to level that playing field. The other big barrier in this business is Excel. That's the state of the, that's the state where you get any information. And Excel has, it's good, but it has its limits. And when you start getting into big databases and trying to find bigger trends, like am I getting paid oil versus all the other oil in the county? Excel falls pretty far short. I was good at seeing those problems in Excel, but I had a business partner that said, I can't see it. So we built some visualization tools that are a stoplight that say, if we set up a threshold and say a mineral owner wants to know every deviation, that means $5,000 or more, our system will go into a red light when the barrel, there's $100 barrel difference in oil between what they were paid and what was reported. Bing, 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 that starts the investigation process using our technology.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Looking to ramp up deal flow for your minerals and non-op ground game? Since 2019,
The Texas Mineral Company has closed on over 120 deals, totaling $110 million in value, with deal sizes ranging from $50K upwards of $5 million. Whether you're looking for white space, permit, duck, PDP, AFE, or wellbore-only deals, the Texas Mineral Company has got you covered. For more information on how to source deal flow from the Texas Mineral Company, please email Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com.
Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagle Ford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information. Farmers National Company has oil and gas experts located across the country ready to provide you unmatched convenience and service for your land management needs. Whether you're looking for turnkey management of oil and gas interests or simply looking for an advisor to help you sell or lease your minerals, Farmers National Company has you covered. Learn more about Farmers National Company's team of certified mineral managers, landmen, attorneys, and accountants by going to fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com. Does your team ever struggle with employee turnover? What about right-sizing your team to fit your company's needs over time? Do you have the right accounting systems and software in place to maintain control and visibility on all your cost centers? If any of these things are challenges in your business, then Opportune's back office outsourcing could be the right solution. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com.
So real quick, so you represent mostly individual landowners, right? On the smaller side, are you representing funds at all, or what does your client base look like?
Yes and yes. I have individual landowners that get $200,000 a year. A lot of the work we do for them is on the land side to help them know what they own. But we also run them through the same robust audit system that my biggest client, their annual revenue is north of $25 million a year in a family office. Recently, a couple of mineral funds, smaller mineral funds said, yeah, we don't do this level of due diligence. I've seen it work in the past. Have at it. Tell us what's wrong.
And so you kind of go in. You input all the portfolio information into your interface, and then you have little triggers that go off. And the client sets the threshold. So if they say, you know, we only want to pay you to do investigative work if we see a $10,000 discrepancy or $50,000 or $1,000, whatever it be. And then you get paid like retainers or percentage of what you save, or what is your model?
It depends on the client.
Okay, got it.
We work by the hour. The other one, we get paid on percent of what we recover.
And then going back to the triggers, I think that's interesting. I'm sure it's a combination of factors. Is it purely a dollar discrepancy in what they're receiving, or is it volumes? Is it like, what are the criteria that you're looking for that are, you know, for folks listening, whether they're individuals or their sophisticated funds, I mean, what are the common things that you see lead to those triggers?
So most of my clients care about dollars. So their triggers are, I want to hear about if something's a $5,000 problem. What leads to those triggers are really three things. Is change. When title changes over between generations, a lot of stuff gets lost through the cracks. And if you're not reconciling the revenue into the land, we let the revenue lead us into the land instead of doing all the land work and then tying it to the revenue. I have one client who has about a year and a half's worth of income sitting out in suspense because it's there from her great grandparents. So that's one area the turnover is generational. But the second one is all these operators change hands. When operator A goes to operator B, a lot of their pay decks are similar. There's a couple of three providers that do it, but one, they can have system problems. But, you know, the biggest problem we find is people just make errors when they code the pay deck. It's from, can't talk too far out of school, but I'm working on one for a mineral fund that has its royalties under state of Texas lease, which calls for cost-free royalties. On their mineral statement, on their statement, it says costs adjustments. and there are negative numbers there for oil. And we're like, bing, 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 what gives? So they just make simple mistakes. Is it blatant fraud, malfeasance? No. I mean, if you put yourself in the operator's chair, they got an impossible job.
Yeah, we're talking about voluminous amounts of data, you know, with all the mineral owners, for sure. You brought up, so it's interesting. You talk about generational transfer and all sorts of different attorneys, all sorts of different landmen or whoever is handling that transfer. So stuff's going to slip through the cracks because it's not completely fluid and standardized, right? So that's one part of it. And so there's a lot of buyers out there that look for those hairy deals and discrepancies and everything. That's a buying opportunity. So good. There's a role for folks to, you know, get their hands dirty and clean that stuff up, if you may. But on the upstream side, we're right now in the middle of what I would say is analogous to the late 90s roll-up consolidation that formed the majors and super majors. So there is a lot of M&A going on at scale, and you better believe in a $50 billion deal, there's going to be some stuff that slips through the cracks for a mineral owner that's making $2,000 a month in royalty income, like 100%. System integration, errors, stuff, you know, getting delayed, you know, any type of changeover. I mean, the mess that's going to come from a lot of this stuff, I imagine, is pretty immense, right? So would love maybe a couple of examples of things you've seen, but I guess, you know, a lot of folks on the management side, they try to do automation on ripping a lot of the data off of the revenue statements, but every operator has a different template, and then the operators change the templates. It's one of the frustrations I've heard, right, from folks managing their portfolios.
So the secret is you have to have standardized information. We can take Excel in any format. The Mineral Fund has sent us their pure check stubs that came out of their accounting system. And as long as we know that's standardized, we can work with that. The other big test for an individual is to get standardized information. And right now we steer people towards MineralWare because their data standardization is as good as we've seen. And MineralSoft has some great data products through MineralIQ. But at the end of the day, you're still left with Excel. Whether you're using MineralIQ or you're using MineralWare, you've got six Excel spreadsheets and you have to integrate them and know what they say, integrate the data so that it makes sense. And then you have to understand what it's telling you and what the implication is. I mean, you could have a five barrel difference in oil, and it, depending on your decimal, that could be a $5,000 problem or it could be a $5 problem. You have to be able to not only digest the data, but you got to put it into perspective on your revenue stream and your payment decimals and your division orders. So it's not a static system. It moves, it ebbs and flows. Again, more of the data chasm that it's not like you're dealing with two plateaus. It's like you're dealing with two shifting seas almost.
Are you serious about networking and deal making in the minerals and royalty space? If so, I expect to see you at the MARC Mineral and Royalty Conference at the Post Oak Hotel in Houston on April 15th and 16th. This must-attend event will bring together over 600 attendees for two action-packed days of networking and discussions. Be sure to visit mineralconference.com to get registered for your ticket today.
Going back, originally you said kind of three major things that lead to, you know, portfolio cleanup. You said one was change of ownership, EMP side, and also individual side. What are the other two major ones?
The other two are mistakes.
Okay.
Operators just flat make mistakes and they code it wrong. The third one is a change in accounting system. You go from a minor to a major and their accounting systems aren't the same and their pay decks aren't the same. And they're the first to admit that they spend thousands of hours trying to get it right and that they don't all the time.
And the mistakes are mostly what? Volumes, pricing, decimal interests?
Yes, yes, yes. They tend to get the decimal interest pretty right because they have a division order to compare it against, but volumes, cost deductions, those kind of things get lost in the cracks. Anything where you have a specific lease that says, this is a nuance on how I get paid, it's likely to get lost in the cracks in any transition.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good transition. You know, when we were talking before this, you talked about the importance of getting a good title attorney on your side, or getting someone to understand your lease agreements at some point. So you just kind of reference that. Why don't you unpack that a little bit more? And feel free to nerd out here. I mean, what are some examples of nuances in a lease agreement that can affect a minerals owner that might get lost in translation and lead to, you know, underpayment of royalty income?
Okay. Starting on the easy end of the spectrum, something like flared gas. You're supposed to get paid on flared gas and lease use gas under the terms of your lease. You might not be. You have to go to the Railroad Commission and look at the different gas volumes and see what that is.
Yeah. So I've actually never thought about that. That's so fundamental, but you know, I understand why operators would flare gas, but if you're a royalty owner, that's your revenue being burnt up in the air. So how do you reconcile that? Do operators have budgets for that? Like flared gas?
They're supposed to disclose flared gas gas volumes at the Railroad Commission. But again, you have to know how to read the commission reports and what the different columns need. Another recent, more prevalent, is with lease use gas and Bitcoin mining. So if you're surface owner and they want to roll a Bitcoin mine in, they have to pay you for the gas as it comes out. And from what I've seen, again, I'm not an attorney and you should consult with yours, but for what I'm seeing, gas used to mine Bitcoin can't be considered lease use because lease use is used for the operation of the wells. You know, another big hot point that's come out is this floating versus fixed decimal. You familiar with?
No, please humor me.
So a classic case is if you have a deed that says the grant is one half the normal 1/8 royalty. And because way back when all they did was pay an eighth. One interpretation or the fixed interpretation is you own a 1/16 interest. Now the recent court case is saying, no, you own a 1/2 interest, not a 1/16. Because you own a 1/2 of the floating royalty rate. Not a fixed 1/16 of the total royalty. So I was just having a beer with a guy at AAPL saying, yeah, that's a major process that we're going back through all of our leases and seeing what the language is, because people got it wrong.
So it's interesting you bring that up. I think it's the same. And again, I don't have a legal background or a landman background to really talk about it in depth, but our recent associates recently became a sponsor of the podcast, and every episode, they have a case law update that they follow that's relevant to minerals. And I forget the name of the case, but it was on one of the last few episodes. It talked about the interpretation of when the title was written in that time and how it's different today versus when it was, you know, right. That original title was scripted about 100 years ago. And this particular case was on a pretty large field and the implication dollar wise was pretty big. So yeah, all that stuff really matters, right?
Right. Pun not intended. You really got to dig into the details. So if you're a mineral owner, you're saying, you know, all this sounds good. How does it impact me? The big picture is if you have one, you should hire a good oil and gas lawyer because they're worth their weight in gold, because they'll make sure the back end provisions are in your favor, not the oil company's favor.
When negotiating a lease,
the more complex your lease is, chances are much higher there's going to be an error. It just is the law of large numbers. Because when they set up a pay deck, they're setting it up for 5,000 people. And if you're one of those 5,000 people, that's the exception, they miss you. Now, to the operator's credit, they admit they made mistakes. And 9 times out of 10, they'll thank you for pointing it out and make things whole. The 1 out of 10 are some nefarious players that seem to perpetually have problems. But
yeah, I mean, you know, I always think to myself that if you're an operator and you're following the rules and you're exploiting these loopholes, you know, the lifeline of any business is operating cash flow. And so if you could retain cash on your balance sheet as long as possible, and you're not doing any, there's ethics, which, you know, I think is up for interpretation, but you're not doing anything illegal. You know, I've always wondered how many operators play that game, But most of the people I talk to say the dollars are so small. Yes, they can, it can add up to a lot of money, but it really is just, you know, in good faith, doing the best they can. And it's just so much volume that it's just hard to keep on track and stuff slips through the cracks. But going back to your kind of 9 out of 10, make it whole. I think where I empathize with a mineral owner is because I own some small mineral interests I've picked up over the years. If I ever had an issue, my stuff is so small. You even think about what the landmen or whoever fields your call from, let's call it Chesapeake, what they're getting paid. It's probably like a losing like proposition for the operator to even try to fix this, just given how small it is dollar wise. So there's that, which is, you know, a challenge, I think, a misalignment in incentives for the mineral owner and the operator to do what's best for their own respective businesses. But then too, it's just, how do you get the attention? And so if you're an individual owner and you kind of knew how everything worked, if you were this lady and you were, that calls you up, that kind of got you into this business, she says, I'm getting screwed. I want to call Chesapeake and sort this out. There's a very good chance she could call up and just never get a chance to sit at the table to fix it. So how do you go about that? Is it relationships and knowing, oh, you got to call John in this department at this operator because he's the guy for that? And it just takes a little bit of figuring out the bureaucracy of it? Or
I would say that's true for the smaller firms, the mom and pops. You got to have somebody that knows what they're talking about. The bigger firms, and thanks to Enverus and Energy Link, they give you online act. They say, here's your owner relations phone number, and here's the owner relations email. And it's my experience is when you send something into that owner's relations email, it gets logged with a case number and you usually get a reply back. Like you would the phone company, we'll be back to you in X amount of days. And it's up to you to follow up with them and stay on them, because it's not, sometimes it's 5 to 7 business days, but sometimes it's 60 days, 60 to 90 days.
I hate sending stuff to info at emails or owner relations at emails. I mean, if I'm sitting there and trying to sort something out, whether it's a leaky pipe in my house or I got to fix the roof or I'm trying to fix my minerals, I want to send it to Brad at, you know, url.com. I don't want to send it to some generic thing. It just, me personally being a biz dev guy my whole career, I want to know an individual's on the other end of that. So if it is 5 to 7 days and it's a system and a process and it works, great. But I can just see myself personally getting frustrated with that.
Right. You know, there's an escalation. You try and give them the benefit of the doubt. They come back to you in 5 to 7 business days. If they don't, get on the phone, call their owner relations in there and stay on them until you get a person. And they'll give you, you can ask and say, who do I need to send this email to? Who am I talking to? Can you give me your name? Or a favorite, and this is a biz dev trick. When you get somebody that is helpful, say, will you remind me what your name is in your email? And who's your supervisor? I really want to compliment them about you, and you truly are going to lay in a valid compliment, but that way you'll have two names to talk to, the person and their supervisor. Little trick of the trade.
No, that's great.
The other escalation is if you don't get it in the first two, then you've got to go snail mail, because under Texas Natural Resources Code, you have to send it registered mail. So if you have a claim or a question, et cetera, and you don't get the satisfaction, then you start going through the snail mail process. And that's when it gets strung out into 30 and 60 days from the notification.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Your property is your legacy, so you should only leave it in the hands of a land management company who has a legacy of its own. If you own oil and gas interests or act as a fiduciary for those who do, you can find a long-term partner at Farmers National Company, who since 1929 has taken great pride in helping clients maximize the benefits of property ownership by providing turnkey management services and by working alongside them through generational transfers of specialized assets such as oil and gas interests and farmland. To learn more, visit fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com.
Since 2019, the Texas Mineral Company has been a leading ground game broker for minerals and non-op deals, closing over 120 transactions across the Permian, SCOOP/STACK, Haynesville, Bakken, Powder River Basin, DJ, and Eagleford. With deal sizes ranging from $50,000 upwards of $5 million and 1.5 NRAs upwards of 3,500 NRAs, the Texas Mineral Company can be flexible on where and how they can source your deal flow. For more information on how your team can work with the Texas Mineral Company, please email Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com.
Scaling up your portfolio while minimizing G&A is the name of the game in the minerals and non-op space. Whether you're a brand new fund, an established team who's growing quickly, or a fully developed portfolio in harvest mode, Opportune's back office outsourcing team can help. Stop worrying about all the headaches that come along with day-to-day accounting and back office operations and contact Opportune today. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com.
Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information.
Hi there, it's Rachel Reese at R. Reese & Associates, your outhouse counsel. You may ask, what's an outhouse counsel? Well, it's a law firm that is focused on the day-to-day legal tasks that normally would be completed by your legal department. Our attorneys in Houston and DFW have spent their careers in both in-house positions and at large law firms and can provide your company with the efficient and responsive service you would expect from your own legal department for things like contracts, transactions, and title opinions at a fraction of the cost of what you're used to paying. So whether your company has no legal department or your legal department is a mighty team of one, we can help. Give us a call at 832-831-2289 or learn more at rreeselaw.com.
I've heard stories of folks, you know, when they acquire a portfolio and, you know, when you acquire a portfolio in the secondary market, it's likely from someone who bought from 150 different owners. And so there's a lot of moving parts. And they'll say, yeah, you know, we bought this 9 months ago. We're still getting it in pay. Talk to me just about transfer of ownership and just that whole process of how long it takes. And, you know, your experience with that and cleaning up issues. If someone's in suspense, right? This is the other thing I want to ask you. What triggers someone being in suspense and what are the remedies for it? Because like for individual landowners, is it, there was one deal I picked up, you know, it was actually a deal that I was supposed to help flip for somebody. And then the buyer agreed to the price, but then wouldn't take it down because the title wasn't clean. And, you know, it ended up that the mineral owner didn't sign a division order. And she thought that someone was trying to take her minerals and she got paperwork. And it was just a misunderstanding on her part. And we ended up buying the deal just because, you know, no one could really touch it with the status of where it was at. And we couldn't clean it up until we actually took ownership of it. So just all things related to suspense payments, the perspective of the owner on the operator side, what triggers it. I would love for you to unpack that a little more.
That all comes down to title. You have clean ownership and title into the entity you're buying it from or into you. Otherwise, the operator puts it in suspense and said, we don't know. The ugly part is it's up to the individual owner to go back to the operator and say, hey, this is mine, and I can prove because of X, Y, and Z why this is mine. You can see why they have to be very prudent and cautious about, you know, letting money go out the door undocumented. But it goes back to title. And your grandparents didn't have it. Somebody didn't sign a division order. That's usually what puts things at suspense. The other one is a lawsuit. So if there is a lawsuit out there, whether it's title or price or something else, they'll put everybody in suspense and say, hey, we're going to wait until the lawsuit.
So there could be a lawsuit not related to you at all. You're just a mineral owner going along for the ride and all your stuff can go in suspense as a result. So let's just say the operator is suing. Give me some examples, actually, instead of me making up a hypothetical. A lawsuit, get my minerals in suspense?
We have one where the original title was not done correctly, and they drilled a unit, started producing, and 6 months or a year go by, and people saying, we're not getting paid right. We don't agree with this division order, decimal, and the operator put everybody in suspense. They said, we have to figure out the title on all this before we can pay you. The other trigger would be if the operators are suing each other. And if there's a title issue and operator A and B are suing each other, they just put that in suspense and say, let's figure out who's the surviving entity first, and then we'll pay people.
Gotcha.
But it's very frustrating. Can I tell you a comical side story?
Yeah, absolutely.
So my mother-in-law and her sister, or her sister-in-law, my mother-in-law's husband's sister, they have identical interests in some minerals in West Virginia. And somebody made a mistake and cut one of them a check for $10,000, and the other one's check was $1,000. Big number. Well, the one with the $1,000 goes down to the Houston headquarters and tries to get in the door, knocking on the door, saying, I'm a mineral owner, and by God, I want to talk to somebody. She didn't make it past the front door.
That's funny.
But it's kind of the reality that if we're in a, this is an unregulated business. It's not like you're buying Chesapeake's bonds, where you have paying agents and all this other legal stuff to make sure you get paid. This is completely unregulated and private contract based. So the potential for errors are kind of high. You know, this is a topic for another day, but it's kind of the same issues with Bitcoin, private ledgers. Do you agree with the private ledger, or could there be some shell games going on and somebody makes a mistake and you're out some money? Fortunately, oil and gas is a lot more tangible than Bitcoin, that there was a barrel of oil produced. But the concept is kind of the same.
Yeah, if I'm listening and I'm saying, I've never looked at managing my minerals and from this lens. If I printed out my lease agreements and I comb through them, I'm not going to understand what's going on with that and how that impacts my minerals, or I haven't done an audit to this level of detail. This is interesting. I mean, how much revenue do I have to be making for it to make sense for the juice to be worth the squeeze to engage you or start engaging attorneys or what have you? I mean, is there any size works, or is there a certain amount that you think starts to justify the efforts?
On one hand, any size works. If you have a family jewel, if your oil and gas is a family jewel and you really want to protect it and make sure that it's there not only for your generation, but the next, it's usually worth the money. The juice is worth the squeeze because you're buying a lot of comfort and satisfaction. If it becomes more of a pure financial area, again, it depends on what you consider the juice and what's the squeeze. In our particular case, people balk a little bit because we charge upfront fees, because it's all of our effort goes into the upfront, and we charge very minimal maintenance fees. So they balk at that. But we've intentionally built our business model like that instead of charging you a percent of your revenue over the next 3 years and knowing that that big upfront fee is going to even out over 3 years. That doesn't make sense. Because again, coming from the securities business, I get paying somebody 5-6% if they're adding value and intensely managing what I have day to day. But oil and gas isn't that kind of asset. Yeah, I'll pay you 6% if you're trying to hedge all my price risk and improve my bottom line performance. That's worth it. But in my book, this is more administration. That's why we call ourselves mineral advisors, not managers.
Yeah, so you're coming in saying, hey, a lion's share of the value I'm adding is upfront. I got to wrap my head around this, get into the weeds, understand it. And then, you know, we have our system and it flags, it triggers, you know, changes up to a threshold you're comfortable with. And then we have a fee to continue to dig in. But other than that, it's minimal and what have you. I mean, it makes sense, right? But going back to your question, so, you know, is it, you said early in the conversation, you had clients from 200,000 a year up to 25 million. Is 200,000 kind of typically what you see?
That's typically where they see they can stomach the upfront fees.
Okay.
Again, our upfronts run in the $25,000 to $50,000 range. Again, that's just the first year. And then it drops way, way down after that.
No, I think that makes sense. I mean, just to give an analogy on the minerals buying front, right? There's a lot of folks listening that say, we love to do half an acre to 5 acre deals. Now, depending on where you're doing this, sometimes running the title can be more cost prohibitive than the actual deal what you're paying on the acquisition side. So a lot of folks who are doing, you know, a volume game like that will either try to front run the title, and if they're going to do it to scale to justify it, or buy production and say, you know what, we're going to really rely on the production, and then we're going to bake in a title failure rate into our underwriting so that if 3% of the title fails, you know, we're building enough margin on our acquisition underwriting to cover that and make our return still whole. So that, you know, that's how folks kind of tackle it there. And then other folks say, we're only buying stuff 25 acres or bigger because we have to justify our cost infrastructure. So in your world, 200 grand and above starts to justify the cost of, you know, you guys digging in and assessing everything and then adding to value. So that's helpful.
Stopping here for a sec to go back to your thesis of people that build in that fudge factor, if you will. I mean, our sample size isn't big, but the errors that we find are in the 8 to 15% area. It's not a 3% problem. It's closer to 10. That's either you need to bump up your discount model or figure out that it pays to dig into the details.
Yeah, that's incredible. I'm pretty sure the answer to this is no, but is there a statute of limitations on, you know, any of these types of errors? If you found that someone's portfolio, there was, you know, errors going back to 1985, can you recoup all that, or does some of that?
If it's a title issue, there's no statute. If it's a royalty dispute or a contract dispute, 4 years.
And by royalty or contract dispute, is that like, what about, you know, incorrect volumes or incorrect pricing or something like that?
Again, I would say 4 years.
So there's a lot, you know, being on top of this is important then, for sure. Because yeah. if you keep your eye off the ball and commodities do a run up and your 10% discrepancy is when a bunch of ducks come online and oil's $100, you know, all of a sudden that's a lot of money. Yeah.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, the other value is it's the belt and suspenders. If you are a mineral buyer, we're trying to put in place stuff that the big boys do. Like I talked to the guys at Brigham Minerals, and their chief accountant is on this. He already has his stuff built into his systems, but the smaller tier of guys don't. So if you're a private equity investor, it adds to the value of you as a mineral buyer to the private equity investor saying, I got belt and suspenders on this, just like the big boys do. Again, it's one of those back office things that, again, it's a 3 to 8%, maybe as much as 15% difference. But 8% increase in your ROI is a good chunk of change.
For sure. And, you know, if you're managing other people's money, there's a fiduciary aspect of, you know, maximizing the value. So I think whether you're big enough to take on the cost of people and systems and technology and everything to try to do this yourself, or with the AUM of your portfolio, that doesn't make sense. You know, working with outsourced solutions like yourself makes all the sense, right? Well, very good, sir. Really, really enjoyed kind of getting to the weeds today. I appreciate you feeling my questions and kind of going down a bunch of rabbit holes. Anything we missed? Anything you want to close out the episode with? The floor is yours, and ways folks can get in touch with you. I think there's a lot of value you bring to the table, and I hope anyone who was interested here in the conversation can reach out direct to you and strike up a conversation.
Please do. They'll have the information available through you, or you can call me on my cell at 512-657-6541, or it's scott@royaltyguardian.com.
Excellent. Thanks again for coming on, and looking forward to connecting in person again soon, and we'll be in touch, sir.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. The Minerals and Royalties podcast is meant for informational purposes only. Tim Powell and the Minerals and Royalties Authority are not promoting any specific securities or investments.
nor are they providing any type of investment advice. If you enjoyed the episode, then I encourage you to tune in more and also check out the Minerals and Royalties Authority YouTube channel. Thanks, and see you next time.